you want a vision of the future, Winston, imagine a boot stamping on a human face forever.
You want answers? I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
Someone is trying to teach me a lesson in futility. Why am I the only one who isn't killed?
They will run you dizzy. They will pile falsehood on top of falsehood until you can't tell a lie from the truth and you won't even want to. That's how the powerful keep their power. Don't you read the papers?
I just want to say one word to you. Just one word.
Yes, sir.
Are you listening?
Yes, sir, yeah.
Plastics.
I'm going to get your money for you. But if you don't get the President of the United States on that phone, you know what's going to happen to you?
What?
You're going to have to answer to the Coca-Cola company.
The world is a college of corporations, inexorably determined by the immutable bylaws of business. The world is a business, Mr. Beale. It has been since man crawled out of the slime.
Welcome to another episode of Our Interesting Times. My guest this evening is Andy Nowicki. Andy, how you doing?
Very good, Tim. Good to be back with you again.
Well, thanks for coming back. I wanted to talk to you tonight about an article that you penned. Well, I think you actually wrote it a couple of years ago, but you reposted it on the anniversary of the Dresden firebombing. And
yes.
In that article, you touch on not just the bombing, but also this a lot of the controversy regarding the war and revisionism and the sides people take and the justifications they make for their respective sides and waging total war and terror bombing and mass civilian deaths. When you wrote this, obviously you were writing this on the anniversary of the bombing itself, so that obviously that was that's why you wrote it, when you wrote it, mm-hmm. But why did you decide to write it?
Well, I initially wrote the article, which is entitled "Dresden Was Not Da Bomb," somewhat of a cheeky title for a very serious and tragic subject matter. Mm-hmm. But that's sort of the way I approach things sometimes. And I actually wrote the article initially 2 years ago, when it was the 70th anniversary of the bombing of Dresden, and I guess I'm just, for a while I've been aware of the double standards that obtain these days, where certain atrocities are recognized as atrocities and maybe even exaggerated to some degree, or, they're encouraged. It's encouraged in our minds to think of them, as mega atrocities, as more atrocious than they can possibly, than we can possibly imagine them being. As if the initial atrocity isn't bad enough, such as what happened to the Jews in Nazi Germany, which of course was a terrible thing. But other bad behavior, evil events, things that were done, that are clearly against the moral law, especially in wartime. The notion that you don't do evil so that good may result, which was clearly not the case in World War II. It was not, as they say, a Manichaean war between good and evil. There were a lot of complications. There was, dare I say, good and evil on both sides, on all sides. And unfortunately, what both sides did were, you know, they both engaged in numerous atrocities. And Dresden is, you know, well, it may not be the example of that par excellence, because there's plenty of other examples that one can point to. And an event like Hiroshima and Nagasaki is recognized in the West, maybe because it was so singular in the sense of being the first atomic attack that ever took place. But an event like Dresden, which was also a devastating event resulting in hundreds of thousands of deaths of innocent men, women, and children, and an event where the civilians themselves were clearly targeted, where it was an event where the idea was to take out as many civilians as possible to weaken the enemy's morale, which was unfortunately not unusual for World War II. But Dresden, you barely hear about, especially in America. Now, when I visited England a few times, for some reason they do seem more sensitive to it, more aware of it. You mentioned Dresden to them, and they know what it is. And I don't know if that's because associating it more with the RAF and Bomber Harris, as they call him, and everything. Although, of course, Americans are culpable in these kinds of atrocities as well. So maybe that's part of the reason why Americans just don't know about it, don't hear about it as much. But I do think, generally speaking, in the Western world, you know, we're supposed to think World War II was an event in which good ultimately triumphed over evil, and recognizing an event like Dresden as the evil that it is really complicates things. And so I felt when I first wrote this article, it was the 70th anniversary of Dresden, the bombing of Dresden, which took place in 1945 and right near the end of the war. And I wanted to address it. I wanted to talk about it. And I wanted to, you know, discuss it in a revisionist sense, in the sense that it's not something you ever hear about on the History Channel or, you know, similar outlets. It's not something you ever hear people talk about. There's never a Dresden Awareness Day or whatever, what have you. There's no monument to Dresden anywhere in Washington, D.C. And I wanted to call attention to it, but I also didn't want to go the other way and just, like I think some do on the alt-right, and just say that the Germans were blameless and that I reject the effort to say, it's sometimes cheekily said, Hitler did nothing wrong, but there's a substance of meaning behind it that's argued by some alt writers, you know, in spite of the trollish sound of it, the hashtag-ish sound of it. And I really reject that thesis as well. And as I talk about in the article, again, Dresden was not da bomb. I think, unfortunately, maybe for some of your listeners, strayed into some profane territory near the end, but I just wanted to illustrate how this war really brought out the worst in just about everyone. And at the end of it, yes, you did have the death of one totalitarian regime that did a lot of bad things, but you also had the strengthening of another one, which was also doing terrible things and continue to do terrible things, and that was the Soviet Union. And of course, the West is not blameless. The non-totalitarian states are hardly blameless as well. So it was just bad all around. And Dresden is somewhat emblematic of this, I argued in my article.
Yes, the Second World War, I think it's easy to say, or suffice it to say, that's a much more complicated and morally ambiguous event than most people have been taught, whether through school or through popular culture, through the movies. most people's familiarity with the war is, you know, whether it's Hogan's Heroes or McHale's Navy, if my listeners remember those TV shows, or, you know, Von Ryan Express or The Great Escape, or more recently some of the Holocaust movies. It's tend to be to dominate
Saving Private Ryan.
Saving Private Ryan or Schindler's List, these things. So this is their perception of the war, and the Germans are always portrayed as sort of
savages.
Savages, monsters, no souls, just cruel, all around cruel. And even the soldiers, you never see their eyes. They're just the helmets, and they're just you know, ants running around being told what to do, and it's okay. I remember I was watching a movie called Monuments Men. It came out with George Clooney. And the storyline is that these guys go behind the lines to save treasures that Hitler's is obsessed on ruining, to deprive, you know, civilization of these treasures that he stole, that his regime had stolen throughout the war. And there's a scene in it where one of the guys, one of the experts, I guess, they're bringing in a lot of ethnographers, you know, people who study the art, so they know what art is, what it's worth, and these things. And one of the guys stands up and goes, "I just want one question. Yes, before going on this mission, will I be able to kill Germans?" you know, and it's supposed to be a light moment in the movie.
Yeah.
You know, there's a movie called The Good German, as if, well, you mean there was a good German, right?
Yeah. So
it's much more ambiguous. You know, as people who actually take the time to study the war and some of the moral problems that the war, questions that the war raised, particularly the waging of total war, strategic, you know, something called strategic bombing, really was carpet bombing,
right.
And the deliberate targeting of civilians, which was a policy on part of the Allies, particularly the British. It is, you know, this thing, this war killed 27,000 people a day. It was waged on, what, five continents and lasted 6 years, and, you know, it was just an all-around disaster. And the problem with Americans, I think, why the British might be a little different is that there might be some, there's a living memory of they were scarred by the war. Their bombs fell on London and Coventry and these places. And, you know, America, the war was over there. It wasn't on her shores.
Except in Pearl Harbor, which really didn't really affect too many people. And, and there's no sort of memory of that.
And what, you know, Hawaii wasn't even a state yet. So.
Right, yeah.
It was a military outpost. And which FDR was advised not to do, not to put the Navy out there by his admiral, who fired, because he, you know, that the story there, they were sent out there to provoke, that's one of the provocations that FDR received to get his back door to war. So that's, I think it's part of the reason is that the war for Americans, I think, is always over there. You know, the last war that scarred this country was what, I guess the war between the states.
Exactly.
Which was an internal affair in many respects. Then, of course, the War of 1812, which our allies in both World War One and World War Two burned the White House. So why were we defending the British Empire twice in the 20th century? But that's a whole tangled web right there. But, yeah, that's you know, it's one of these things. We're talking about war itself. The idea was the 20th century, and I think the advent of total war, I think Americans got a taste of it during the American Civil War. When the
Southerners did,
The Southerners did, when the Union Army waged total war on the South and targeted civilians, burned cities. This was Sherman's March to the Sea. He declared he was going to make Georgia howl, you know, and the Shenandoah campaign with General Thomas, and you know, so that was the beginning of it. But of course, you had World War One, which by World War Two standards was rather limited because cities generally weren't bombed, although they. You know, the Germans had the big Bertha gun. They could shell Paris and things like that. But it wasn't a strategic part of the war. World War II changed because of the development of aerial of aviation and its application, its military applications. And, of course, the bombing. That was the big thing, the bombers. But prior to that, I mean, if you think about it, since, I guess, the 30 Years' War, there was this notion of limited war or civilized war. There were rules. And that attitude reigned. I guess that's part of the democratic era, because part of total war is part of our democratic age. Because prior to the rise of democracy in the West, wars were considered, you know, a royal affair, and they were private wars.
Right, and I've even heard. I have a hard time believing this, but I've heard that there would be times where families would go out and have a picnic and. Watch battles happen on, you know, a field close by, and
that happened
binoculars and such.
That happened the first Battle of Manassas, Civil War. And of course, so, they were so shocked.
Surreal, but
they were shocked because the Confederates routed the Yankees.
Yeah,
and they're hightailing back to D.C. Because if you're familiar, I actually live near Manassas Battlefield, and I go over there, and yeah, they could picnic it, and it was considered like a volley or something you could watch, like a tennis match.
Yeah,
it's so weird. That quickly changed in Civil War America.
I live in Georgia. I grew up in Atlanta. I live in Savannah now. And
so there you go.
Savannah is the only city that was really spared. It's the only one where there's buildings that date back from before 1865, in Georgia.
All throughout the South, you had Sherman smokestacks, right?
Exactly. And Atlanta was burned to the ground and had to rise again from the ashes, as it were.
I read an account as late as the Franco-Prussian War, when the Germans, the breakthrough at Sedan, and they defeated the French. The Germans, as they advanced, the officers stayed at hotels in Paris, and not in Paris, but in France, on their approach. And they paid the hotels in gold coin. They felt obligated to pay for the hotel rooms as they invaded the country. It's a whole different era. I guess
there's always something a little surreal about those kinds of war and those kinds of events. But I think another thing I wanted to draw attention to in my article was the illustration that accompanied the article actually got it kicked off of Facebook because it featured nudity, but the nudity is of a certain contextual nature that lends it a measure of irony, and that is a couple of years ago. You haven't really heard much about this. I don't know if they've Soros has turned off this spigot, but back in 2015, so it's funny to say back in 2015 when it's 2017. But remember the femin used to be everywhere, these women who would go around shirtless and like they would run up and cause all this chaos. I mean, they were sort of like the Antifa, but they didn't really engage in violence so much as just be, I'm not even sure what they were supposed to be, but just be obnoxious.
Just sort of moral iconoclasm or something. Just shock everyone's senses.
That's true.
Yeah.
And the picture that accompanies my article is of a couple of masked women, bare-breasted, and they're standing in, I guess it's somewhere in downtown Dresden today, and they're on their stomachs is written, "Thank you, Bomber Harris." And so these are German women, I guess we don't really know what where they're from, but they're standing in the middle of Dresden where this terrible atrocity happened and making light of it. And it just sort of gives some context to where things are today, where we find the it's obviously meant to shock and provoke and upset people, but turn it around, you wouldn't find I don't imagine you'd find similar groups going through Auschwitz with their saying thank you Himmler or something like that.
yeah
It just wouldn't happen, or if it did happen, it would be the you'd hear about it everywhere, and it'd be the most terrible thing that could ever conceivably be done.
That comparison itself, people would find they'd bother by that comparison because I think utility of the Holocaust narrative is to obscure the Allied crimes, to somehow justify them. Right?
Yes,
that's in many people's minds. It's because the Germans did that, this is justified.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And also shows how let's assume they are German because it's a German city, although we can't make those assumptions now in European cities anymore.
Right.
They look German. I saw the picture. Yeah. They look all very modern German. The idea of the psychological warfare that has been waged against the German people and European civilization in general, this is the pathological guilt, the self-hatred, which is part of the psychological warfare of that, what Germany was subjected to after the war. Idea that there's something evil about being German in and of itself.
Yes.
And that's what you're seeing there. Thank you for, for incinerating our people,
our grandparents, whatever.
We were just that bad. And the whole point of your article is that, guess what? In that war, there were angels and devils on both sides, and it was a horrible thing. And it's a war. There's a book called The World War II. It's a war that had many fathers. And it really did. Yeah. It's not just one thing. I'm sorry, you were on a train of thought. Go ahead.
No, well, this, I think that also, I'm just sort of wondering lately why we don't see the feminine anymore. And of course, in Germany, I think this was just in the very early incipient stages of the refugee crisis. Maybe they were just opening the floodgates to all the refugees coming up from Syria, quote unquote Syria, and wherever else. And since then, of course, it's become a full blown crisis in many places all over Europe, but especially Germany. And so there's something especially poignant, I think, about this, this effort
to pathologize
Germanness and to
ethnic
make Germans,
pride.
Yeah, to pathologize their ethnic pride.
Germans aren't allowed to have ethnic pride. Yeah.
Yeah, and to taunt them, and whoever was doing it, whether it was brainwashed Germans or brainwashed members of some other European nation. I mean, they were clearly white, these women, from their chests, you can see their complexions, but
they're very white. Yeah.
Yeah. Yes, not very tan. So it's. Put in a certain context, it kind of underlines where things are and where things have gone even since then. Because when this, when the Dresden anniversary rolled around again in 2017, I don't know why I didn't repost this article in 2016. I'm not sure why it didn't occur to me to, but. When 2017 rolled around, it was Dresden again, and it's been a while, and so I thought I would just, it's still newsworthy. It's still something that's worth drawing attention to and talking about, because people don't talk about it as much as they should. Then it just occurred to me that, things have changed even since then. The picture of these feminine demonstrators sitting there taunting Germany rubbing German faces in the mud for and thanking the destroyers of the city and the mass murderers of hundreds of thousands of people. And since then the circumstances are different even now, and maybe the tide's about to turn. There's certainly a lot more of a sense of apprehension, would be putting it mildly. I mean, there does seem to be a sense that Europe doesn't really need to take in any more of these refugees, that it's causing a crisis, that not that these people shouldn't be taken care of, not that it's not a humanitarian issue, but the idea that somehow they should just have dominion to flood all across Europe and all across the Western world, create the kind of chaos that's been created. It seems like.
Well, yeah. Well, no one's addressing why are they being chased out of their native lands, and it's because these wars have been fomented by the Gulf states that are backed by the Anglo-American Empire and NATO. And yeah. these countries are being intentionally destabilized, whether that's Libya or Syria. So these areas can be weakened or harvested, of whether it's cheap labor or sex trafficking or even human organ trafficking, from what I understand. And just the order to fulfill the Israeli objective, which is weak Arab states. And this also serves the purpose of creating a crisis in Europe. There could be multiple reasons for that. I've speculated maybe it's the way to drive down the euro and support the dollar. Maybe it's an overall, you remember, you've had statements about by Peter Sutherland from Goldman Sachs, this oligarch, also by Wesley Clark, the former head of NATO, that the notion of the European ethnic state, the age of the ethnic-based European state is over. Now it's mm-hmm. a multiculturalism. It's a multicultural gladiatorial pit they're creating.
Right.
You know.
It's a cudgel by which they can bludgeon the yep. West into submission or drain the West of its ethnic identity and make it just this polyglot sort of easily ruled.
Which makes people easily govern or to rule over because they don't have any community or ethnicity, real bonds to family, community, religion. Ethnic, and Europe's been mm-hmm. subjected to, this has been going on since, the middle part of the 20th century, because you had the trauma of the two world wars, which I think created a sort of pessimism and a lack of belief, a loss of religious faith in Europe, which led to population decline. And then, of course, all the toxic, pop culture of the West was imported from America to support all the sexual license that has afflicted these countries. This leads to rapid population decline and overall demoralized society, and that's why you get, I think why was it like nihilism and pessimism spread so, so far and wide in Europe in the aftermath of the world wars.
And it's interesting how the in the early part of the 20th century, the rulers, the would-be rulers, what do we call them? I know they're called oligarchs a lot, but I'm trying to think of a better word or a more original thing to call them. But I don't know the those who would be who
powers
want,
that shouldn't
who,
be.
Yeah, the powers that shouldn't be, to quote James Corbett.
Yeah, I love that.
The in the early part of the 20th century, they were discussing eugenicism. That eugenicism was the big thing. They were talking about they were alarmed about the rising tide of color and about how there was these bad genes that were increasing and multiplying, whether it's undesirable races or undesirables among the white race, and that something needed to be done to cull the herd. And now, and they were sort of, but they were broadcasting it in this what we would call today racist sense. Like, we've got to have the best and the brightest, and we've got to have a race of thoroughbreds, like Margaret Sanger apparently said. And it seems now that the ruling class is these same people, these same powers that shouldn't be. They've flipped. Flip the script, to use that tiresome expression, mm-hmm. but it's still where it's like now, oh no, it's multiculturalism is the way to go, and if you're a native Westerner, then you should feel you should feel guilty over your white privilege and this, that, and the other. But it seems that they're pursuing a lot of the same ends, and it's just the other side of the coin, and the whole idea of. You hear some people on the alt-right talking about white genocide. That's sort of like a term that's caught on. But I don't think that really – that doesn't quite express what's happening, because, yes, they are trying to make white people feel guilty over their heritage and make them feel like they don't have anything really to offer, that their own ethnic background is just a history of bad things, and that they're at best they're just bland and colorless and whereas the blacks and the browns are so much more lively and really really more human, and just so we should learn from them. And this is the sort of what they're communicating today, but it seems like I mean, when last I looked, most of the rulers, most of the oligarchs themselves are white, and it seems like what they're using white guilt to shame the whites who they see as beneath them, the whites that they want to subjugate and rule over. And you know, white guilt doesn't seem to, you know, you don't hear check your privilege, Bill and Melinda Gates, check your privilege, Bill and Hillary Clinton. You know, they don't, that, and they're more privileged. I mean, it's the more privileged people lecturing, you know, regular, normal white people with, you know, no particular privileges to speak of.
Like Bill Kristol talking about how the white working class should just go away and be taken over.
Yeah.
He's savoring the decline of this white working class, largely Christian, maybe, perhaps, and that might be, there might be an ethnic a basis to that thing. If you go back,
I'm not saying that this elite, if you want to call them that, isn't a significant Jewish component to it.
Which might explain part of the twist, the sort of dysgenic approach, divide and conquer, diversity stuff, because diversity is our strength is a motto that was created by the Anti-Defamation League. And what they meant by that was diversity is our strength, meaning that if you weaken the host of society, you break, homogeneous societies or high trust societies, but they're kind of the outsider. And Kevin McDonald's written about this.
Sure.
This is a survival mechanism, and it can make sense to a certain extent. And you can actually justify it to a certain extent, but when it becomes malicious and it becomes as weaponized as it indeed is becoming, you got to fight back a little bit. Now, one thing is the notion of white itself. White itself is a construct. There is no white ethnicity. There's Irish, there's German, there's Polish, there's even, you know, there was a time when Irish and Italians weren't considered white, at least not by the WASP majority, but they became white, right?
There's a time when it was just sort of Anglo, white was synonymous with being Anglo.
That was it, yeah. And but this happened. I mean, I think I've talked to you about this in a number of interviews with E. Michael Jones, talking about the breakup of the urban Catholic neighborhoods, the diaspora and the suburbia, the creation of suburbia through all types of social engineering schemes, the interstate highway system. You had the 30-year mortgage created by the government to encourage suburbia, these homes. And of course, once you broke up the ethnic neighborhoods, they lost their ethnic identity, their religious identity. They became the bland white middle class that could be they were deracinated, had no cultural ethnic roots anymore, and they could be turned into this sort of this mindless consumer, debt enslaved consumer. That's what we have today all across America. So when people look to defend, a lot of the alt-right looks at, you know, white genocide, we need to defend white culture. Well, there's no real white culture to defend. That itself is a construct, and that's why it's difficult to articulate or to defend, because, you know, there's a sound basis for defending, you know, Scottish culture or Irish culture or German culture or Polish culture, and you have a right to, you know, there's nothing wrong with defending your ethnic culture, and there's nothing wrong with ethnic differences. In fact, we enjoy ethnic differences. We like Chinese food, we like Italian food, you know. Some people like German food, but
or even English food.
Well, we like German engineering, right? Or German classical music. So, so all around we benefit by the interaction of these different ethnic groups, but not the melding of these ethnic groups.
Yeah.
And what do you get when you melt? You melt it down, and what do you get? You get like this horrible mash of food. Something, you know, like a, you know, you don't want to mix everything together because it doesn't match.
Beige now, culture, as they like, as yeah. a beige or, power.
Or monocultures. And if you look at it from a business modeling standpoint, from a marketing standpoint, a monoculture is much more easy to market to. This is why, you know, you walk into a town in Germany and you run into a Starbucks coffee and a Walmart or something.
Yeah.
And the same thing you run into if you're in Seattle or Baltimore or Dallas, you know. That's what you're getting now. And that's all part of this, I think, overall corporatist plan to make everything the same. And but bringing it back to the World War II, and World War II is a big part of this. I've had a number of discussions with Jay Dyer about when he did the Tragedy and Hope analysis. And part of the war itself was part of a phase to move from a multipolar to a bipolar to a unipolar world, and that's what we call the New World Order. And the war itself was part of that phase. You needed the wars to create the break up multipolarism, to smash Germany, and to rope in Russia. And the irony is that both Germany and Russia, what occurred there in the middle part of the 20th century, was part of an Anglo plan to meet the this overall objective. But let's getting back to the war itself. I mean, we're talking about the conversation started off talking about the firebombing of Dresden, and of course the strategy of terror bombing by the Allies against Germany. There's a great description of course the thought process that led to that policy in Paul Johnson's book Modern Times, and he explains it well here. He gets into the overall policy of terror bombing by the Allies and also Dresden itself. And he says here, says the devastating combination of high technology and unrivaled productive capacity took its most palpable and significant form in offensive air power. There were two reasons for this. First, the British persuaded the Americans it was the best way to make the maximum use of their vast economic resources while suffering the minimum manpower losses. Second, the bombing offensive appealed strongly to the moralistic impulse of both nations, what the British atomic scientist P.S.M. Blackett called the Jupiter complex. Now, that's important because that Jupiter complex still exists today with drones. The notion of allies as righteous gods raining retributive thunderbolts on their wicked enemies. We see here the corrosive process of moral relativism at work. Churchill was well aware of the moral decay war brings, was appalled by it. Well, maybe not so much. You know, he loves Churchill. He had initiated the mass bombing strategy on 2nd July 1940 because he was overwhelmed by the prospect of Nazi occupation, the ultimate moral catastrophe, and saw bombing as the only offensive weapon then available to the British. This was the old utilitarian theory of morals. It's Jeremy Bentham, right? As opposed to the natural law, which ruled the direct destruction of war-waging capacity was the only legitimate manner of conducting combat. But all forms of moral relativism have an innate tendency to generate moral collapse, since they eliminate any fixed anchorage and launch a ship of state on an ocean where there are no bearings at all. So that was a good description of why that policy was undertaken. But the operation against Dresden was called Operation Thunderclap, and this is how it's described. The attack was carried out in two waves, with a third by the United States Air Force, because that's Army U.S. Air Corps, I think, at that time, in accordance with the Bomber Command's tactic of the double blow, the second falling when relief forces had concentrated on the city. Over 650,000 incendiaries were dropped, the firestorm engulfing 8 square miles, totally destroying 420 acres and killing 135,000 men, women, and children. As it was the night of Shrove Tuesday, that's like Fat Tuesday here, many of the children were still in carnival costumes. I mean, this is the beginning of Lent. Yeah. Back then, many of them were still Catholics and Christians. For the first time in the war, a target had been hit so hard that not enough able-bodied survivors were left to bury the dead. Troops were moved in and collected huge piles of corpses. The center around the Altmark was cordoned off. Steel grills 25 feet across were set up, fueled with wood and straw, and batches of 500 corpses were piled up on each and burned. The funeral pyres were still flaming a fortnight after the raid. Goebbels claimed it was the work of lunatics. I thought that was a good description of what we're talking about here.
Yes, from somebody.
Okay, we're back. So go ahead.
So, yeah, that is a good description from somebody who is obviously on the side of the British and who has a British bias, but also feels the need to tell the truth about certain things, which is always nice and always refreshing. And yeah, you can't wage that kind of war without dehumanizing the enemy. And I guess to some extent that's just to be expected in war. You know, there's two sides to every conflict, but the propaganda effort is to try to enhance your own side's sense of righteousness and draw attention to the evils committed by the other side, and in order to make your that's just sort of the way that it unfolds. I mean, war is, psychologically speaking, it requires the Manichaean mindset in some ways, because you can't deal with the cognitive dissonance otherwise. And of course, it's a difficult thing, because sometimes war is necessary, unfortunately. And I, you know, I'm not a pacifist in the sense of thinking that violence should never be undertaken, but it does seem that once the choice is made for violence to be undertaken even for defensive purposes, you know, even in a just war kind of situation, something that the church that the historical church would acknowledge as a just war, it still seems like, and maybe this is just where original sin seeps in, as it always does, that there's always going to be this kind of abuse of, you know, every righteous cause gets abused, and gets even the most righteous of causes, people end up doing terrible things, thinking terrible things, saying terrible things, you know. And World War II was far from being just a simple case of one side defending goodness and righteousness against the tyranny and evil and wickedness and inhumanity of the other side, as we were saying, you know, mm-hmm. A little while ago. So I guess there's just something about the whole aura of war that encourages this kind of moral fog, you know, even in the best of situations, and World War II was hardly the best of situations, mm-hmm. even when it comes to war. It was probably the worst, as far as death and destruction, it was probably, in the, you know, percentage-wise, because there weren't as many people living in the world back then, but I would think that if you just tally up all of the deaths, both civilian and military, that it was probably a greater percentage of the human race than had ever died in any conflict prior. And there's going to be some mischief, and there's going to be, you know, the evil finds its way in to all sides, one way or the other. So I guess what I'm saying is, it's one of those things where it's part of the tragedy of it. It's part of the tragedy of humanity that you know, even evil comes out of evil can come out of the best of causes and the best of mindsets and the most righteous of perspectives, evil still finds its way in.
Well, we'd look at World War II and the destruction that it created, that occurred during the war, and we look at it sort of as being inevitable, and the atrocities being inevitable. But the atrocities themselves were a function of the war itself. And mm-hmm. neither of the combatant countries on both sides would have been able to do what they did if not for the war, the cover of war, and the moral decline that occurs in war, what Paul Johnson talked about. So it's moral declination that occurs when you start down that path. Mm-hmm. This applies to both sides. It applies to the Third Reich. It also applies to the Allies. There would not have been the mass rounding up of Jews and putting them into concentration camps and exploitation of their slave labor if not for the war. And yet, if they go back to who started the war, a lot of people look back at the Germany's invasion of Poland in 1939. But, of course, if you look at the true history of that, is what Germany was dealing with. Germany was trying to revise the Versailles Treaty, and just this, the Danzig crisis was going on in Poland. And Poland itself had been a very acquisitive power in the years leading up to the war. They took a big chunk out of Czechoslovakia. They mm-hmm. were very militaristic. And they also had designs on Russian territory. Because remember, Polish independence was a new thing. Prior to that, Poland had been controlled by Germany and Russia for a better part of 300 years, whether the Prussian state or in Germany or by Russia. Mm-hmm. So this was a new thing. I think when war broke out in 1939, the Polish independence was less than 20 years old. So this was a reversion to the pre-World War I borders in many respects, but nevertheless, France and Britain decided to declare a war over a border dispute in Eastern Europe, and this was something they had no power to reverse anyway. People forget that France and Great Britain declared war on Germany. So, Germany's technically speaking, Germany's offense in the West was not aggression, by all, you know, because they had already, France and Britain had declared war on Germany. Even Germany's assault on Norway, which they merely beat Great Britain to the punch. Britain was trying to invade first, so they're all doing that. That's what happens, and that's it's nothing really new, nothing unique. You can criticize, but it doesn't distinguish Germany from other countries, other great powers. All of which had huge empires engaged in some form of aggression or another to acquire their empires. Britain didn't acquire its global empire by consent, you know. You know, we hear about obviously the horrible death toll in the labor camps, and of course there's a lot of dispute about what was really going on there, because there's a lot of post-war propaganda for post-war reasons. But we hear very little about things like the Bengal famine in India that the British created by exporting all the food. And this was a forced famine that killed, you know, over 2 million people. And that's as brutal as anything Stalin did in the Ukraine.
Right. That's what it makes me think of the Ukraine.
Yeah. So, I mean, but we don't hear about that, nor are there movies, nor are there monuments made about it.
No.
Isn't much recognition given to the Ukraine. And you ask yourselves, why were people in the Ukraine incentivized to sign up with the Ukrainian SS battalions because they were fighting the Russians, and there were many of the executioners in Ukraine were Jewish, Kaganovich, and these people. Same thing in the Baltic states. So there was a lot of payback going on here, that we Americans have a very triumphal view of the war, and we don't care about the complexities that was going on there. But a lot of Russians decided to sign up with the Germans to fight Stalin. A lot of Ukrainians did. You know, a lot of Lithuanians did, and they weren't Nazis. They were just caught in a vice grip, and they were making the best of a very bad situation. And it isn't to say that, particularly the war in the East, when you had these, the Einsatzgruppen and these police battalions going on, carrying out this anti-Kamazar order. What happens? This was very much like what was going on in Vietnam with the Phoenix program. So before you condemn Germany and as being uniquely evil, this happens in every war, you know, and it's horrible. It's a reason to not to go to war, because these things always happen when you send young men into a foreign land armed, and this is going to happen. And because what happened even in Russia, what happened? Stalin would dress people up as German soldiers and commit atrocities. You can see that happening. And there was a case in the Donbass region. This was in the summer of 42. The Germans were driving south, I think, towards the Black Sea of Stalingrad. And they intercepted a train that was being... This was forced. These were people being removed. Ethnic Germans and... I think they were Georgians and Georgians, I think. Ethnic Georgians. They were being removed by Stalin to send to the Gulag or labor camps.
His own countrymen.
Yeah, and the Germans liberated the train.
Because he was Georgian.
The German soldiers liberated the train. And many people survived the war because of the Germans. You know, so from their standpoint, the war is very different than maybe a Jew might remember the war, who was put into a labor camp. This is how complicated it is.
Yes, sure.
You know.
Now, this is kind of tangentially related to what you're talking about, but something I've wondered about lately is, it seems like if we're talking about propaganda or the arts, and sometimes the line is blurred between those two. It seems like in the last few years, there has been a rash of movies that have been very, and this is culminated in the new Mel Gibson movie. The name of it escapes me right now. The one that was, I think it got some Academy Award nominations.
About the medic?
About the pacifist.
Yeah,
the medic.
Conscientious objector, pacifist.
Rich
or Hill?
Yes, yeah, that's right.
Rich, right?
Right. This movie and There was another one a couple of years ago that directed by Angelina Jolie, Unbroken.
Yes.
And there was this new Scorsese movie. This wasn't set during the war, but Scorsese's my favorite director. And he directed this movie called Silence, which was based on an account of the time in the, I guess it was the 17th century when the Japanese powers were persecuting Christians, you know, just this intense and
that's right,
very very cruel, you know, to a great extent. Not that persecution is ever nice, but they really had some inventive ways of just you know, tormenting and torturing people. Called this movie called Silence. And it seems like there's been a couple of others that where the Japanese just don't come across all that well. And it's interesting to me in our age of political correctness, maybe we're starting to come out of political correctness now. I don't know, mm-hmm. a little bit, but it seems like it's now accepted to have movies which present the Japanese in a extremely negative light, where, you know, it's like yellow man bad, white man good. You wouldn't think that would fly in our day of political correctness, but
it's like movies in the 90s with the Arabs. Remember
well,
that?
Yeah. And it's like the exception is made when it's the Japanese.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been wondering about that. Do you have any thoughts about that?
Well, you know, the Fu Manchu thing, early 20th century, the mm-hmm. Orient, the idea, you know, the barbaric East and all that, Orient and all that.
Right.
So that goes way back in like an American culture.
Sure.
I think it was Harry Truman was reading
The Inscrutable.
Yeah.
they used to call them.
Yeah, but he used to write in McCall's magazine like these serial stories about evil Chinese and Asiatics coming in and taking over the West, and this would form. Mm-hmm. His, you know, obviously this would form or somehow have some impact on the decisions he would take years later when he was president, right? I mean,
mm-hmm.
there's a reason, you know, you could, you know, firebomb and kill as many Asians, you know, and this coincides with America's expansion into Asia.
Sure.
And in order to justify that empire, because it was very brutal, people don't know about how the Philippines were subdued, you know, hundreds of thousands mm-hmm. of Filipinos perished in that war. It was very brutal. You know, and a lot of those practices were applied home, and a lot of the soldiers came back and became police officers and used those tactics on minorities here in the United States. So, you know, the empire has come home, right? I mean, that's a...
Right.
And I think it was Alfred McCrory wrote a book about that. It's called Policing America's Empire. It's about the occupation of the Philippines and its impact. The same way the Phoenix program in the Vietnam War now is the template for Department of Homeland Security.
I know George Webb has been talking a little bit about that.
And also Douglas Valentine's book about the Phoenix program. He made that point back in the 90s. Mm-hmm. This is back in the 90s in his book on the Phoenix program that this was being applied domestically. You know, Stasi guy was the consultant for how the DHS was going to be set up. You know, these.
Oh, really?
You know, the lives of others, those people.
Oh, sure.
So this is, you know, the same way in World War II when they brought over Galen and the Nazis to form the Soviet desk. Because that's how you have the Cold War. You want them, because they're the ones who knew how to fight the Ruskies, because they've been fighting for 4 years on the Eastern Front. So you got to incorporate them, and then they're going to have an effect. And all the...
Operation Paperclip.
Yeah.
And all that.
All that stuff. Right? So, and the reason for Operation Paperclip is multifaceted. It wasn't just that. So,
sure. But, well, my thesis for why it's now okay. I mean, I think with all of what you're saying is true, and it probably has existed in a low level like kind of way, and hasn't been discouraged, or a high level kind of way. Even if it's, you know, even if we're living in a time where racism is considered the sin against the Holy Ghost.
Yeah.
If you're white, to be racist against others. But I think that now my thesis, my idea, it's not really a hypothesis. It's not really.
No, I think you're onto something.
I'm wondering if it has to do with the opening up of China. If, you know, China's a bigger market now, and, you know, they make movies and geared towards the China market.
Oh, that's Hollywood being taken. You know, they're buying into Hollywood pictures, and they're
and the Chinese hate the Japanese.
Yeah, and they have all those dollars to spend that they've accumulated.
And now and so maybe being on. Maybe being anti, maybe making these movies with that with an anti-Japanese kind of aesthetic.
That's not, I mean, obviously the Jewish domination from Hollywood affected how things are portrayed.
Yeah,
it's affected the Hollywood product, whether it's the movies, the, you know, with the smut and the sex, and also with the World War II interpretation.
Yeah,
and as the Jewish influence became more prominent in the, after the 60s, you notice that the Holocaust itself came to define the Second World War. If you watch movies made about the Second World War in the late 40s, 50s, and mid-60s, the Holocaust plays a very little role in it. It's like a it's hardly even you don't see it in The Great Escape. You just know the Germans are bad. You don't see it in Von Ryan Express and these things. But it's in the 70s and the rise of the neoconservatives and the I guess you could say the decline of the WASP elite and the ascendancy of the of Jewish power in America. Overt, I think. It was always very significant, you know, affecting media, music, entertainment, and these things. There's an ethnic component to this, and it serves certain geopolitical interests, whether it's Zionist interest or Chinese interest. Yeah, you're onto something.
I'm talking about might be more of a commercial endeavor that, that it's, you know, it appeals to the Chinese to show the Japanese in a bad light.
Mm-hmm. And so, it's a huge market over there, what you're saying, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, that's opening up more and more. I don't know. It's just an idea, just a thesis or a hypothesis, really. Mm-hmm. But
well, you heard about what happened with the remake of Red Dawn, right?
Yes, I'd forgotten about that.
So that's
It was how it turned out. They were going to make it. Were they originally? It was going to be a Chinese invasion,
which is ridiculous. But it's somewhat more. Just looking at the size of China.
China has a more significant.
They got enough people to send over. Population. They could get them over here, but North Korea and the United States. that's more like the mouse that roared, isn't it? I mean,
yeah. Yeah. I'd forgotten about the Red Dawn remake. I actually saw it, and it really tickled me, the whole North Korea invasion of America. That's pretty wild.
That, you know, it's... You know, that is funny. Yeah, that's a good point, though. You're right about how they flex their muscle.
Yeah.
Financially, whether it's sort of some sort of geopolitical or cultural agenda or just simply to cater to the burgeoning market over there for movies.
Yeah, yeah. That's just my thought on the whole thing, because it is striking. When you watch Heartbreak Ridge, I think that's what it's called, or Unbroken, you really have this aesthetic that might seem quote unquote racist to many people, because you've got these, you know, strong, hardy, you know, white guys doing their duty in hellish conditions, being menaced and, you know, sadistically treated by these, you know, filthy infernal Japs.
I mean, Well, to this day,
they don't make it as it's not as open or upfront, but aesthetically speaking, it's all there and it's in your face, and you know they don't they don't skimp on the atrocities, you know.
No.
and it is almost Manichaean, you know, white is good, yellow bad, and it's really quite extraordinary to see this bumper crop of movies. I guess Silence is a little bit, you know, different because it's set in the past, and you know, I think it has more artistic integrity in a way, but it's of a piece with some of these other, you know, bigger budget, more significant movies that, you know, these World War II movies set in the East. And so it's just striking. It's just one of those things I've noticed.
You know, that's the impression people get of that war, because the war in the Pacific was much more of a racial war than it was in the European theater, for obvious reasons, because you had Italian Americans, German Americans, French Americans, and from all accounts, the prison Germans, if you look at the conditions of the German prison camps, they did the best. Prisoners were treated rather well, in relative terms.
Mm-hmm.
The survival rate was, I think, was over 90%. You know,
yeah, sure.
You know, and so
Abided by the rules of war. What do they call the
Geneva Convention?
Geneva Convention rules.
The Red Cross did it, and also the prison camps were run by the Luftwaffe, which really wasn't controlled by the Nazis. And that's we see that actually if you watch Hogan's Heroes, that's actually you see that element to it portrayed in that. Also another in The Great Escape, where you have. You know, the Luftwaffe is an old gentleman soldier running it, and he doesn't like dealing with the Gestapo. In the East, I mean, in Asia, in the Pacific Theater, Americans quickly gained the reputation for not taking prisoners, and a lot of that was because the reports of the Bataan Death March and the fact that they hated Japs. There's a racial thing, of course.
Yeah.
Here in the United States, Japanese in the West were on the West Coast were forced to sell their property and live in concentration camps. In fact, a funny story is part of the Hyatt Hotel Empire is based on property that was stolen by the Hyatt family through some of their friends in the federal government. Yeah. Stolen hotels and properties and all that. I read about that in Gus Russo's book Super Mob about the Jewish Mafia. One of the reasons why Japanese were so ferocious, we think it's because the Bushido warrior ethos they had. Well, one of the things is that the Americans didn't take prisoners. And there's a picture. How brutal this was is how there's a picture in Life magazine of a pretty girl writing a letter to her loved one overseas, and she's staring at a Japanese skull.
I came across that. That is pretty striking. That would be an interesting thing to link to. Mm-hmm. If you can find it.
Yeah, what's that? Yeah, I see. Going on, just put a Japanese skull. So this was the hatred that. Americans call Germans krauts, but listen, they really dislike the Japanese, and it was a racial thing, and that's one of the primary reasons the Japanese were so ferocious and didn't surrender, because they were often get machine gunned, and it's wartime, and it's their
their home too. That's another thing.
Yeah, Okinawa, these and it's much easier if the person you're killing looks different than you. And Germans and Italians, they don't look very much different than us, and that's a racial element to it, though. And that's also when the Russians advanced into Germany and they raped so many German women. But a lot of that weren't the first line soldiers. There was the Mongol soldiers that came in, and of course they were encouraged by Ilya Ehrenberg, the Soviet propagandist, Commissar, who encouraged them to rape, take their women, rape them, and kill them, kill their children. All Germans are fascists. They must all be killed. The entire race must be wiped out. And he has a memorial in Israel today at the Yavad, at the museum there.
Wow.
And I mean, like you said, there's a lot of blood on everyone's hands.
Yeah.
And there was a racial thing. It was a racial thing to go in, and that's an old war thing. When you go in to conquer land, what do? You take the women and you taint the bloodline. That's
it's old as time.
Yeah,
it's in the Bible too.
Yeah, and another thing the problem a lot when people talk about Allied war crimes, people think you're excusing Germany's war crimes, and you're just engaging in. A historical correction or rebalancing, so it appears everyone knows about the German war crimes. And of course, I think there's more controversy in the degree of it and the reason for it. I think there's reasons for debate there that shouldn't be illegal, nor should you go into prison for it. But you've heard about Eisenhower's death camps.
Yeah, I have, yes.
Yeah, 2 million soldiers just put out in the open and left to die. We weren't allowed to. They were denied Red Cross packages, and then the German citizens themselves weren't allowed to bring food and water and clothing to them, and they just left to die. And Eisenhower made this decision. And
of Eisenhower as such a great guy. And he was the one who targeted the military-industrial complex, even.
Yeah. The thing about that is what I'm thinking is that it appeared to be a partial implementation of the Morgenthau Plan.
Oh.
And you know, that called for the destruction of, you know, the deindustrialization population of Germany.
Just the deindustrialization, making them into a pastoral place. Just wiping out all vestiges of modern civilization.
And you have Kaufman's book, Germany Must Be Destroyed, written in 1940, American. And so they're calling for the destruction of Germany. And so Germany, when the Morgenthau Plan was released, obviously the Germans realized that obviously we can't surrender to these people.
Yeah, that doesn't help matters, does it? Yeah.
But it would appear the objective was to drag it out as long as possible, do as much destruction as possible. Because part of the psychological warfare, cutting off, decapitating the German people morally and intellectually, would be destroying Dresden, destroying these historical German cities so they can put up modern cities. And they're cut off from their past. And I think the two topless women you see, you refer to, are a product of that... Of that process, because these old German cities have been around for millennia, and that's culture. That's something to be proud of. You destroy it, no longer there, and you get easy to undermine the native culture, which is what imperialism is mostly about, right? That's the psychological conquest of the natives.
And maybe just to bring this full circle, you know, you talked about how there wasn't really much of a discussion of Holocaust related stuff before the mid-60s or thereabouts. In an interesting way, there's an interesting sort of mirroring there with Dresden and other Allied war crimes, but it's particularly Dresden, because it wasn't until, I guess, the mid to late 60s that it was really David Irving who first shone the light on what happened in Dresden. And he published his book, what was it, 66, 67?
Yeah.
Sometime around there.
And he was in his 20s.
Yeah. And it was, of course, he's a very controversial figure today, and he's gone a lot farther in the other direction, but somewhat of a notorious character. But really, that he deserves a lot of credit for bringing attention to what really took place there. And also... We should acknowledge Kurt Vonnegut.
Oh yes, Slaughterhouse Five. Yeah,
his novel Slaughterhouse Five, which also that was sort of the centerpiece. I mean, it's this kind of weird postmodern book with this narrative where the guy travels time trips and goes from the past to the present to the future and all this stuff, and it's really weird and surreal. But a big chunk of the book, and again, in some ways, the moral center of the book is the Allied attack on Dresden and what resulted and the effect that it had on the main character of the book. And I think that was the first maybe major fiction work that drew attention to Dresden. And that was also maybe around the same time, maybe a little later than Irving's book.
Well, the book, the movie came out in the early 70s. And that's why I first got when I was watching, like, you know, I remember the old days when you got network television, you had the late movie on Friday or Saturday night,
like
2 a.m, you'd stay up late and watch these weird movies that you could never catch. And that's why I first started Dr. Strangelove, was like 2 a.m. on a Sunday morning. What is this? You know, not knowing what to make of it, because I'm only 13 years old. You know, and of course, I'm 50 now, and I still don't know what to make of it. But that's the whole point. That's Kubrick's genius, I guess. But I saw Slaughterhouse 5. I think I was like 13 or 14. It's the weirdest movie ever. You know, it's one that just draws you in. Mm-hmm. And I saw the movie, you know, before I ever heard of the book. What is this, Dresden? And you did. Got your. One of this thing is the people. Well, I guess justify it because they think, well, you know, it was war. We needed to do this. Obviously, when you're bombing the German cities, the Germans have to devote planes to defend the cities. That takes them away from the front, particularly the Eastern Front. That was one of the reasons why the Germans lost the air superiority in the Eastern Front, was the requirement to try to defend the cities from bombing. So you could make a military argument, although that is still utilitarian. It's not morally justifiable because in the old days, you don't target civilians. That was the idea. You don't.
There's a code of honor.
You don't say, well, less soldiers should die, so in order to prevent soldiers dying, we need to target civilians. The idea is soldiers were legitimate targets, citizens, civilians weren't. But this,
when you say the old days, of course, you mean a certain period of time in the Western world between the late 17th century and maybe the
into the mid
19th century.
Yeah, probably as late as the 1870s, probably. Yeah. I think it has to do a lot with, again, like I said earlier, it has something to do with the democratic age and the people's war. Everyone's now engaged. Economically, it's total war. Everything's a target now. Factories, you know, this mechanization of warfare. So you have to bomb the factories. Yeah. People live near the factories. So, that isn't the case. Because, first of all, the bombing, the airplanes, the resources that the air war took were huge, and it took away from like maybe campaigns in the Battle of the Atlantic. And also, I think it was the average loss for every sortie was 10%. So if you're flying 10 missions, you have a good chance of getting blown out of the sky.
They were definitely taking a lot of hits there.
But even according to these War Department's Strategic Bombing Survey of 1946 said the air war itself actually inhibited the war because it stiffened Germany's back. It actually increased morale. It didn't demoralize the public. It actually people became to like anything. You're going to support your government when they're
bombing. It had the opposite effect.
Another thing is they underestimated Germany's ability to adapt. I think German war production peaked as late as the fall of 1944, then plummeted. But if they had just targeted the oil fields and the rail yards and the bridges and refinery centers, Germany would have not had any fuel and would have been able to wage war as long as she had without the fuel. Mm-hmm. I think by May 1945, Germany, they didn't have enough gasoline for Hitler's Mercedes. But if they had done this earlier in the war, in fact, they even say if the British, instead of bombing Berlin in 1940, had targeted key bridges and transport areas, it would have severely limited Germany's ability to wage offensive war in the early part of the war. So it really was a misdirection, but it leads me to believe that maybe something else was was the objective.
So you think that maybe it was the leaders the Allied leaders were so
the high cabal, as Churchill referred to. I think you have artificial leaders, or the leaders that are retailed to us, the Roosevelts, the Churchills.
Yeah,
but they all talk about a high cabal, and even Roosevelt talked about that, and that we're really ruled by personages we never see. And I think if you look at the long stretch of what the war represented, and you take into Anglo-American, particularly Anglo, but it became Anglo-American strategy, was this Mackinder Doctrine. And the idea was Britain always sought to destabilize and weaken the continent, and it always played powers off against each other on the continent, whether it's France, or Germany, or Russia. And, of course, the big thing in World War One was this Cordial Entente, Entente Cordiale, Reggie, when England decided to align itself with France against Germany and then divide Germany from Russia, and the thinking that England didn't have the capacity to really go after Germany directly or Russia directly, but if she could get Germany to fight Russia, then weaken both, and that would weaken the continent, Germany, and it would prevent the Eurasian landmass from unifying and developing, and that certainly helps England maintain her global dominance as a seafaring nation, as a naval power. And we see that analysis is important is because we see it being played out today with the Russians and trying to play the Russians against the Chinese and trying to divide Russia from Europe and these things and fearing Putin's Russia. And so,
that raises the question was, are all these new developments going contrary, like the election of Trump and the passing of Brexit and the rise of nationalism in the West?
I believe it's some kickback. I think it's some resistance to it.
It's not part of the plan. You're saying you don't think that it's like a It's like
I think maybe this is the optimist speaking, because I could just say that everything's controlled and there's no point to it all. But things are more complex than that. I do think things are largely orchestrated and managed, but within that management, there's developments that they don't plan for and they have to improvise. And I don't think the ruling, the self, anointed ruling elite are monolithic in these things. And I've talked to a number of people regarding about Trump and what he represents. Trump represents sort of a branch of the elite that said we need to kind of rein it back a little bit. Globalism has gone too far. It's time to kind of perhaps reinvest in the United States.
Talked about this last time, I remember.
Yeah. So I think there's the same thing with the Brexit, and that's why some people call Trump's election American Brexit, because it's very inchoate. It's not really well defined what he represents, what he's doing. I saw an interesting headline the other day, just buying a cup of coffee at a 7-Eleven. It goes, what newspaper was that? It was Bill Gates. And Bill Gates sees nationalism as a threat to global order.
Oh, boy.
I bet he does.
And that's a good thing.
And I guess, and all, like I said, I'm not, I don't necessarily think that government's initially good or nationalism is always good, but compared to globalism, it's a healthy thing because it's a form of sort of maintaining somewhat, some semblance of local control in your life. Yeah, you know. It's the same
as what's happening now is an organic, it's not just part of the dialectic, it's an organic reaction.
Well, I think there's an element that it's organic that will be, obviously, exploited. Will try to be managed.
Yeah.
Obviously be managed. So, you know, that's, there's dialectics and there's trialectics and quadrilectics. These things. But there is some spontaneity, there is some, I think some, they don't control everything. They control the broad, you know, cultural agenda, the network news, the entertainment you see, even the music. But in the end of the day, we haven't been completely assimilated into the Borg yet. So, and they got
to
cope with
it. Yeah, that's a good thing to remember, that not everybody is, they're not all powerful and they're not all knowing. And, you know, they may be clever, but they're not, there's some things that happen that are beyond their control, and I think we give them too much credit sometimes by just saying,
Well, that might be part of the psychological warfare.
Yeah.
It's the point I talked to Jay last time, talking about, he wrote that thing about Trump, which got him a lot of criticism also.
Yeah.
But I see his point. What he was saying was that, you know, if you read 1984, you have, Winston being told that if you want a vision of the future, O'Brien telling Winston, if you want a vision of the future, imagine a boot stomping on a human face forever. Now that, you know, that's rather demoralizing.
Yes. Yes.
Right? I mean, and I made the point, that's true. I mean, he said, if all was hopeless, I wouldn't have, I just said the Jays, if all was hopeless, I wouldn't be having this conversation with you. If they controlled everything, I wouldn't be reading the books I read, you know? So, I mean, and despair is the ultimate sin. Right? I mean, that's the one you can't.
There's something lazy about it, too. I mean, it is a sin, but it's also just like, you know, it sort of gives you permission somehow to not resist, to not do what you need to do, because what's the point? They're going to win anyway.
I mean, if it were hopeless, I wouldn't have six children. I wouldn't be homeschooling them.
Good job.
You know, these things.
I've just got two, so you're way more hopeful than I am, clearly. Three times more hopeful.
Yeah. And like I said, having children is the most fulfilling and also the most frustrating, terrifying thing you ever do. But a lot of people, remember, for entire generations have been, not entire generations, but large portions of the generation, I've run into so many people who said, I don't want children. It's so bad out there, you know.
Yeah. Why bring a child into this world?
You know, I was like, what? I mean, well, you know, there's one way you can make it better.
Yeah.
Raise a decent human being.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's,
Which can be done.
You know, I'm not, you know, storming the barricades. I'm not changing I'm not overturning the New World Order, you know, but I am changing the world.
Well, you are in your own way.
I'm changing the world in one small way.
Small but significant way.
Yeah. And that's what they don't want you to think.
Yeah, sure.
you know, that's what all this, you know, environmentalism about, you know, this catastrophism and all this stuff is about, you know.
Yeah.
Isn't to say there aren't real problems out there, you know, but a lot of the stuff is just meant to demoralize you. And that's when I think a lot of, you know, they hear stories about, you know, total surveillance and these things. They want that to have a chilling effect, you know.
Yeah, and I sometimes wonder if, you know, there are people like, you know, if you follow social media or you go on YouTube or whatever, just if you're part of the dissident culture in some way, there's, it seems like there's always these kinds of nattering nabobs of negativism who you hear from now and then, and you're tempted to wonder if they're not shills sent there to demoralize, or if the other possibilities, they could just be people who actually have given up hope and are just now being lazy because they're hopeless. And either way, it's something to be resisted.
Yeah, because that's the ultimate, you know, it's the ultimate defeat is despair. And
yeah,
you
know, sure. You know,
that's what Judas did wrong, right?
Yeah.
When he hung himself.
Yes, that's right. He could have been, even with the terrible thing he did, he still could have been forgiven.
Yeah. And so that's what people have to remember when we're talking. You know, it can be a little overwhelming because there's so many lies and there's so, it's like, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And it can be overwhelming if you decide to, you know, take it, you know, try to swallow it all at once, you know.
Yeah, sure.
To me, it's been a gradual thing. So I haven't quite had the same shattering of illusions that maybe some people experience. You know.
Right. Well, we all approach it in our own way and with our own baggage, and we all have to do our part.
Yeah. So, but going back to this thing. So, this article. You were just pointing out one point I wanted to bring out was the reason why it matters, because, you know, the bombing campaign itself against Germany, of course, I mentioned how it actually inhibited the war effort and just caused needless destruction. Of course, that might have been part of the idea, was to sort of psychologically decapitate the German people, which was all part of the Morgenthau plan and being called for, both not only by Jewish power, but also by British power.
And even though they didn't follow the Morgenthau plan, they did end up dividing Germany.
Yes, they did. So it was implemented in somewhat. And you see, I guess I mentioned, you know, Eisenhower's death camps and these things. It looked like they're part of what was indeed implemented. The whole idea of the bombing campaign itself as being vital to the war effort would affect war planners in the Cold War. Because obviously we saw what happened in Vietnam. Okay, in Korea, where Korea was just bombed, pretty much obliterated, North Korea was pretty much obliterated by American bombs, napalm, and also bombing. But this Jupiter complex, because, you know, of course, in the Cold War, we had the development of Strategic Air Command and Curtis LeMay, who got control of the nuclear arsenal. And, Curtis LeMay, who wanted to, I think it was LeMay, you horse your development of MAD, which is, you know, people say it worked, but it only worked because we were lucky. No missiles were launched. It works as long as the missiles aren't launched. Yeah. So, you know, it's a tough way to find out that the doctrine is false, you know, when you're suffering through a nuclear holocaust. Oh, I guess we were wrong. But Curtis LeMay, I mean, this guy who ran the Strategic Air Command, he was a product of of the Allied air campaign, particularly against Japan.
And he was a nasty son of a bitch too, like Bomber Harris, wasn't he? I mean, he just wanted to kill them all, basically.
And you have Henry Hap Arnold, who wanted, after Nagasaki, mustered a 1,000-plane raid on Tokyo just to see that he could get 1,000 planes in the air at once.
Mm.
And this is after Nagasaki.
Yeah.
And this is, of course, Tokyo was slammed in March of 1945. They burn, you know, we think of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, but the firebomb, the conventional raids were as bad.
Sure.
Were as bad. Obviously the moral threshold had been crossed. Of course, with the development of the atomic bomb, a technical threshold had been crossed. But Curtis LeMay, who I think he actually drew up a plan. He wanted to drop nuclear bombs in Vietnam and drew up a plan in 1949 to destroy 77 Russian cities in a single day. Preemptive war. Because we got to bomb them and get those bastards now before they get us. This is the madness that this Jupiter complex creates.
Jupiter, that's like God, but like a pagan version of a God complex.
And LeMay, he's the one that he talked to his, I guess, the civilians who were his superiors. I ask you, would things be much worse if Khrushchev were Secretary of Defense? Obviously, they don't want to start bombing. They're communist. But then his successor, his successor was Thomas Power over there at SAC, Strategic Air Command. And LeMay himself said Thomas Power was not stable and probably a sadist. That's LeMay talking. And LeMay ran as Governor Wallace's vice presidential candidate in 1968. He was on a ticket.
Oh, wow. You know what? I didn't even know that.
Yeah.
That's really something.
But Thomas Power, he says, when Iran's study advancing limited nuclear warfare reached his desk, he says, this is from the Rand Corporation, and Power asked the guy who presented the report to him, why are you so concerned with saving their lives? The whole idea is to kill the bastards. At the end of the war, if there are two Americans and one Russian, we win. So they inherit this burning cinder called Planet Earth. We win.
But they win. At least they won.
So there you go. You know, this is the mindset that's created by this. And of course, with that, you also get McNamara, who was LeMay's war planner in Japan, over Japan, and he goes to work for Kennedy. You know, actually, first Ford Motor Corporation and produces the Edsel, I think. But
And I point out in my article, too, how the people who who committed this atrocity at Dresden, you know, nothing happened to them. They were feted afterwards as heroes. But if the war had gone the other way, they would have been in the dock just like, you know, we saw the various, you know, the various people at the, in Nuremberg, 1945 and 46, they would have been. I mean, I remember seeing a picture like from I think it was a sci-fi alternate history thing. And it was the same kind of iconic picture of all the Nazi war criminals standing there, you know, like with the wearing the thing on their head, the headphones and stuff. But this time, instead, it was Stalin and Churchill and Roosevelt and. it was pretty good. It was pretty interesting. It made the point that you know, everyone was a war criminal, but the only ones who got punished were the ones who lost.
Admiral Nimitz made that observation, I think, too, about trying some of the Japanese war criminals and some of the. But the Nuremberg trials, of course, the Nuremberg trials, all rules of evidence were thrown out, and it was a show trial, and you know, and you had testimony gotten under torture. We know that now; it's admitted. There's an interesting episode at Nuremberg trial when Hermann Göring, who was weaned off opium for and was lucid during the trial, had sort of a comeback, rhetorically speaking. He was being cross-examined by Justice Jackson, who was the prosecutor there, the Supreme Court Justice Jackson. And Göring admitted to the charges that he had planned to assist in ending the Weimar Republic and revise the unjust conditions of the Versailles Treaty. He bluntly admitted that he planned to do this by rebuilding the German Air Force and using military force to correct correct these wrongs in his mind and revise the Versailles Treaty. If not, they couldn't do it through diplomacy. They were perfectly willing to do it through force. Then Göring stated that he had planned to use military force to achieve these political objectives as a statesman, and had done as other statesmen had done throughout history. And some of the British justices admitted that, they really couldn't argue with that. It was no different than any other politician or general. You know, it's one of these things where, you know, again, were the Russians really? Allowed to sit in judgment of the Germans at Nuremberg, the Russian Germans, with things they did. And exactly. Same things go for the British, the Americans, and the French, because they all had their empires and spheres of influence.
Yes.
you know, they had gotten through similar means. It just wasn't, you know, they just weren't they're losers.
Yeah.
You know, so.
Absolutely.
So, Andy, any other observations? Anything that I'm missing in this article that you want to get out or that you want to address?
No, I think we've pretty well covered it. I would just say that, you know, I felt particularly compelled. I feel particularly compelled to talk about things like Dresden, mm-hmm. just because they are, number one, so worth talking about in any sense, no matter what, because it's such a significant event and such a an obvious war crime, but also because I think that it's worth drawing attention to things that need to be paid attention to, but that are maybe inconvenient to our would-be rulers and what they would like us to pay attention to, and the kind of way of viewing things that they would like us to have. And so that's what I see it as my role to talk about things like Dresden. Not, and again, I think I try to make this clear in the article, not because I want to go the other way and lionize the Axis powers and demonize the Allies, but just because it's in so many ways so emblematic of what's happened, what's gone on, in one way or another, and it's in various dimensions of what they call man's inhumanity to man. Who do you know who said that in the first place? Who first talked about it? It's a very pompous sounding phrase, but I hear it talked about a lot, but I don't know who said it.
Yeah, I know who said it. It's like the banality of evil.
Maybe it's one of those things. I mean, it's been overused, but it's one of those, it's what I see Dresden as being emblematic of in so many ways. And so, I hope your listeners, if you haven't read it yet, will maybe go over and check it out.
Mm-hmm. Now, you don't have the article at your fingertips there?
I don't have it at my fingertips.
Well, just to give it justice, I'm going to read a couple paragraph from it.
Yeah, sure.
Because you make this point, and I think you make it well here. If one removes one's partisan blinders, however, one cannot escape noticing that World War II was little more than a massive campaign of unremitting carnage and horror, regardless of whose side you took in the affair. Paleocons, isolationists, Buchananites, anti-welfare, warfare state libertarians, and other contemporary intellectual dissidents have often pointed out that, contrary to the rah-rah triumphalism trumpeted by both the mainstream right and left, the outcome of the war was, in fact, deeply deleterious to much of the world, particularly Eastern Europe, which was immediately subsumed by Stalin and reduced to Soviet helotry, following Churchill and Roosevelt's skullduggery, betrayal, and capitulation at the Yalta Conference. But it must be added, as a counterweight to Sepp's observations, that a National Socialist victory would have also had a similarly dire results for much of the population of Europe. In the post-war world, a man like Alexander Solzhenitsyn emerged as a gusty and courageous witness against the pathological tyranny of Bolshevism, but no less righteous were such stalwarts against Hitlerian totalitarianism as Klaus von Stauffenberg and Hans and Sophie Scholl. If we overemphasize one gross, ghastly form of oppression at the expense of the other, we do the victims of each bloody regime a disservice. So,
well,
lest anyone think we're not praising Hitler here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, and I actually get in trouble with some of my readers because there are some sympathizers with National Socialism, and I wrote an article about Hans and Sophie Scholl actually on the anniversary of them being put to death in Germany, and got a lot of flack for it, but I stand where I do, and I try to stand on the side of righteousness and not take a partisan stand.
Yeah. And again, a lot of these people are caught in the middle of something. You know, if you're a German and you're thrown into this maelstrom, what do you do?
Yeah.
You know, yeah. And so yeah, it's, you know, again, if you look, like I said, the war, I don't think you can separate World War II from World War I. And also, I particularly, through my research, I look at the meta level, and when I examine the meta level of the war, I point a finger at Great Britain, and it's geostrategizing against Germany and then Russia.
Yeah.
And it's perfidious Albion that's the center of this. You know, you know, and yet problem with war is you just can't go to 1939 or 1938 and look at you know at Munich or you know or the Rhineland or. You know, yet you go back further and further in history. Both the Bolsheviks and the Nazis crawled out of the trenches of World War One, and so it was a reaction to something. And yeah, but yeah, you're right. It's just as you said in that article. It's the whole thing was just darn lamentable. Let's just say that.
You know, tragedy.
But we don't. Again, the real tragedy is the people's tendency to feel triumphant. Do you have a picture in there of these soldiers, the victors or something in the article?
I think you. Colin also wrote Colin Liddell.
Yes, right. I read that article too. Yeah.
About Dresden. And I think that might be what you're thinking of.
So and look, he writes it from a British perspective. I think he's a British expat living in Japan.
Yes.
And how the British Empire itself was just, you know, was this husk of an empire, of a state after the war. How the war exhausted the British Empire after that.
And, yep, pretty much.
At least as an overt power. I think the City of London still carries a lot of weight in the world these days.
Yes, that's true.
They sort of transplanted over to, the empire shifted to the United States after that.
Mm-hmm.
So. But that's how these Venetians operate, I think. It's, you know, the black nobility, that's the theory. They go from country to country and take it over for a century or so, then move on.
That's like the history behind the history.
Yes.
What we don't see.
The Venetians, the black nobility, that's doing it. So, well, Andy, listen, anything else? I mean, I've had you for an hour and a half. Is there anything else you want to?
Yeah, no. I think that's that. I think we've
did we cover it well?
We've been pretty exhaustive and covered the whole ghastly spectacle.
Yeah, it's not a long article. It's Dresden was not the bomb. I highly recommend it. Also recommend the article that's linked by Colin Liddell regarding Dresden. It's an article. It packed a lot of. I mean, not many words, but there's a lot of insight in it, so I thought it warranted a longer discussion. And so,
yeah.
You know, so I invited you on. Thanks for coming.
Well, thanks for having me.
Great. That's Andy Nowicki. He's the author of Conspiracy, Compliance, Control, and Defiance, a primer on what is to be done. And he's the assistant. You're still the assistant editor of Alternative Right?
That's correct.
Okay. And, of course, you do the Nameless Podcast, right?
I do the Nameless Podcast. I also join the Boiler Room crew.
That's
on
right.
Thursday nights. I've written the book you mentioned as well as several others.
Great. Well, listen, Andy, thanks a lot for coming on. And I will we'll talk again in the near future, I hope. And
yes.
When I post this, I'll send you the link. You know, I might stagger this one a little bit. So you know, it might be a week or so, but I'll send you the link when I do it. Because it's not topical. So
timely. Yes, that's
so
true.
I can do it.
Although I guess we're getting out of the. Well, I guess we're post Dresden now.
Yeah, post Dresden anyway. But not many people think about.
So it's not topical in that sense either. So yeah.
Valentine's Day overshadows Dresden all the time.
So. Well, I've sometimes wondered if. Never Dresden Valentine? Why has that never been a title for something.
Yeah.
They intersect. All right. Well, thanks again. It's been fun.
Great. Thanks for coming on and take care and enjoy what remains of the winter and spring will be here soon.
All right. Great. You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Long, long time ago, I can still remember how that music used to make me smile. And I knew if I had my chance, that I could make those people dance. Maybe they'd be happy for a while. But February made me shiver with every paper I deliver. Bad news on the doorstep. I couldn't take one more step. I can't remember if I cried when I read about his widowed bride. But something touched me deep inside the day the music died. So bye-bye, Miss America, I drove my Chevy to the levee, but the levee was dry. Them good old boys were drinking whiskey and rye, singing this will be the day that I die. Tells you so. Now do you believe in rock and roll? Can music save your mortal soul? And can you teach me how to dance real slow? Well, I know that you're in love with him, 'cause I saw you dancing in the gym. You both kicked off your shoes. Stole his thorny crown. The courtroom was adjourned. No verdict was returned. Yet while Lennon read a book on Marx, a quartet practiced in the park, and we sang dirges in the dark. The day the music died, we were singing bye bye Miss American Pie. Shed it to the levee, but the levee was dry. Them good old boys were drinking whiskey and rye, singing, this will be the day that I die. This will be the day that I die. Helter skelter in the summer swelter, the birds flew off with a fallout shelter. 8 miles high and falling fast. It landed foul on the grass. The players tried for a forward pass with the jester on the sidelines in a cast. Now the halftime air was sweet perfume while the sergeants played a marching tune. We all got up to dance, oh, but we never got the chance. As the players tried to take the field, the marching band refused to yield. Do you recall what was revealed the day the music died? We started singing, bye bye, Miss American Pie. Oh, we shed it to the levee, but the levee was dry. Them good old boys were drinking whiskey and rye, singing. Generation lost in space with no time left to start again. So come on, Jack, be nimble, Jack, be quick. Jack Flash sat on a candlestick, 'cause fire is the devil's only friend. Oh, and as I watched him on the stage, my hands were clenched in fists of rage. No angel born in hell could break that Satan spell. And as the flames climbed high into the night to light the sacrificial rite, I saw Satan laughing with delight. The day the music died, I met a girl who sang the blues, and I asked her for some happy news. She just smiled and turned away. And I went down to the sacred store where I'd heard the music years before, but the man there said the music wouldn't play. And in the streets the children screamed, the lovers cried and the poets dreamed. Not a word was spoken, the church bells all were broken, and the three men I admire most, the Father, Son, and the Holy Ghost, why, they caught the last bus for the coast the day the music died, and they were singing, bye, bye, Samaritan.